Welcome to Recovering Evangelicals, a podcast for people who were once very comfortable in the Christian faith until the 21st century intruded and made it very hard to keep on believing. I'm your host, Luke Jansen.
And I'm Scott Dyer.
Over the past few weeks, we've reached out to several scholars and asked them the simple question, why do religions care so much about sex? We first asked a non-believing ex-Mormon clinical psychologist because he recently published a paper in a scientific journal asking that very question and gave us his perspective on this very straightforward biological, psychological aspect of human existence. We then talked to a Jewish scholar with expertise in Judaism and Christianity because of her expectation that Christians would inevitably point to the Old Testament positions on sex and gender. And last week we talked to a Christian scholar with grad-level training in both Christian theology and clinical psychology and who teaches human sexuality at Fuller Theological Seminary, which claims to be the largest multi-denominational seminary in the world, to get his perspective on this central question, why does Christianity care so much about sex? Today, we'll talk to another Christian scholar to also get her thoughts on this from a very different angle. Dr. Sarah Mosleiner is a professor at Central Michigan University in the Department of Philosophy, Anthropology, and Religion, who has published many papers and taught many courses in the areas of religion, gender, and sexuality, often with an eye to the historical development. She's been studying evangelical purity culture for over 15 years and has numerous publications, including the book Virgin Nation, Sexual Purity and American Adolescence, published by Oxford University Press. And that'll be the focus of our conversation a bit later on today after we get to know Sarah. And finally, she heads up the After Purity Project, which we'll hear more about later on in our conversation. So Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you, Sarah. I'm quite intrigued by this whole topic. It's quite relevant in my own experience because I've had some experience with the culture and with the reaction to it as well. So, yeah, very interested to hear what you have to say.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, before we get into your unique perspective on this story, let's find out a bit about your own unique story. Mm-hmm. In doing some background looking into your work and what you do and finding out about you, I saw on your page, your website, you say, in high school, you were a fierce advocate for the countercultural teachings of Christianity and that you're proud of not fitting in. So why don't you tell us about that earlier part of your Christian journey?
Yeah, so I was a very ardent, very pious, evangelical Christian school kid, mostly because that was my personality. I was someone who, if you give me rules, I will keep them and I will excel at them. By my senior year of high school, I won two awards for being the best Christian. I came from a very award-focused form of evangelical Christianity. So for me, having clear rules meant I knew how to excel. And so that's what I did. And so I was very much informed. In fact, I didn't realize this as I was working on my dissertation on purity culture. It wasn't until after, in fact, my book came out, that I had a recollection that in high school, I wrote a letter to the editor of my local paper arguing against comprehensive sex education and arguing against the assumptions that teachers in the public school were making that you couldn't teach abstinence-only education because that was unrealistic. Teenagers are having sex. And I took great umbrage at that and had to write this letter, which was published in my local paper. So that I think is a good kind of snapshot of who I was as a teenager. Like I wanted to live, you know, I wanted to be the best at living by the rules and I reap the benefits of it. And then I went to college and I realized that the frameworks that I had from growing up were just not expansive enough to help me make sense of the world. And I wanted my world to be bigger. I went to a Christian college. I went to Calvin, what was then Calvin College, which for me was like huge and vast compared to where I was coming from. And I studied theater. And so, you know, was really making decisions about wanting to be in bigger worlds that were more morally complex. And the Christianity I grew up with just did not have the tools I needed. And so I very quickly started moving away from it, asking a lot of intellectual questions, asking a lot of questions about, you know, this new thing I found out about called feminism. And that just sort of hit me in the gut real hard. And I was like, whoa, I need to learn about this. And that really shifted things for me.
What faith tradition was that you grew up in?
So I grew up, my father was in the PCUSA. He was a pastor. So the church we went to is PCUSA, but I went to a parent-run Christian school that was in the Reformed Presbyterian tradition. And also, so my world was more Reformed Presbyterian, Presbyterian Church in America, right? So that type of Presbyterian community. And so my dad spent many years teaching at Geneva College, if you're familiar with it. And the school I went to was kind of nicknamed Geneva Prep, because it sort of funneled people to Geneva. So for me to go to Calvin was a bit of a turning my back on already, you know, just doing that.
And Sarah, because you grew up in that evangelical culture, you were probably influenced by a book that sold 1.2 million copies worldwide. Everyone's heard of Josh Harris's book, I Kiss Dating Goodbye. I think it's safe to say that was instrumental in a new movement that we want to talk about, this whole, well, I think it's a new movement, but I will eventually talk with you about how this actually has very deep, distant roots. But it was fairly new, at least in the evangelical world that I was part of. So maybe tell us a bit about the influence that that book might have had on you at that time. We're still dealing with your personal story, and then we'll get into the gist of your thesis.
So I'm actually a little older. And so for me, the stuff we had was Josh McDowell, right?
Oh, okay.
So this was before, right? So the Why Wait. So I watched those videos in Sunday school. I knew kids who wore like the Why Wait t-shirts. And then by the time I left college in 96, I was pretty much out of the evangelical world. And so it wasn't until my dissertation that I read the Harris book. And even then I was like, ooh, like it was, and this is interesting because, you know, I did my graduate work out at Claremont Graduate University, right? Which has all of these undergraduate schools, like very prestigious schools and not at all like a Christian environment or an evangelical environment. But I, you know, so I had to request the Harris book from Interlibrary Loan for my research. So I went to pick it up, and the person at the library desk said, "We get requests for this book all the time. It is one of our most requested books," which was really incredible to think about that students at the, you know, at the five C's, as they were called, the Claremont colleges, were reading this book. But yeah, so personally, I missed all of that. And that was really because for people who were teenagers in the mid to late 90s to the 2000s, right, that was really the height of evangelical purity culture and the kind of full cultural saturation of it. And interestingly enough, everyone read Harris's book. Yes, I mean, it was ubiquitous, but it was only a tiny part of everything. And I think the person who's really struggled with it the most is Josh Harris. And even in my, because I've interviewed 65 people in the last 3 years who've grown up and out of purity culture, and his book doesn't, you know, comes up at the same rate as every other book. And so yeah, I think he just had sort of an outsized representation.
And what was driving the purity movement at that time? Why did it reach such a big crescendo?
So there were several factors, many of which had nothing to do with religion. A lot of it had to do with the political climate and therefore federal funding. So starting in the 1970s, you have funding for Title X, which was for comprehensive sex education. And so then there was an immediate backlash to that from people like Orrin Hatch and Jeremiah Denton, who were part of the religious right movement. And so they tried to get funding for abstinence-only education starting in the early 1980s. And that was caught up in the courts for almost a decade. And so it wasn't until the late 90s that you then get this huge amount of money dedicated to abstinence-only education. And that was because of the welfare reform bill that Bill Clinton signed in 1996. That Reagan had introduced, that Bush wasn't able to push through, and it wasn't until Clinton, and they attached funding for abstinence-only education to the federal welfare reform bill, and that made money available to faith-based organizations and had very particular rules about what you could teach, and it was all informed by groups like True Love Waits from the Southern Baptist Convention. So there was a political groundswell that made it possible. The other thing that happened is the SBC threatened a boycott of Disney and ABC because in the 1990s, ABC had a sitcom in which the first person ever came out as gay, and that was Ellen DeGeneres. And the SBC took Disney and ABC to task and threatened boycotts. And though they were never successful, their campaign of intimidation was powerful enough that Disney started creating ABC Family, right? Which was this family-centered, right? So they felt this pressure to be family-centric in the way that the SBC defined family. And to say that Disney has never been family-focused is... right, is absurd, right?
Yep.
But not in the way that the SBC wanted. And then what starts happening in the 2000s is you have all these current and former Disney kids who are wearing purity rings. And that's when we meet kind of peak saturation in terms of the influence. And there is a very good chance that that was also part of the influence of the SBC on Disney. Which is really interesting to think about what's happening now with Disney in DeSantis's Florida, right? And so they've completely shifted away from that, which is really interesting to see that change that has happened. So, so there's several different confluences right now from the perspective of those who are going to be promoting these organizations and trying to get money, right? They're going to be looking at things like what they see as an increase in teen pregnancy, which was an increase in teen pregnancy among white teenagers. They're going to be influenced by people like Charles Murray, who wrote an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal called The Coming White Underclass, which said, you know, if we don't do something about the rates of teen pregnancy, the economic and social status of white people is going to decline. And so making this a very racial and racist argument. And basically saying, like, we're going to become as bad as Black people are. So very racially coded kind of stuff, right? So it's no surprise then that this funding is attached to welfare reform legislation, which is deeply influenced by sort of these myths of the welfare queen, right? And the idea of who is taking advantage of welfare. So there's all sorts of things happening, right? And certainly a growing awareness of HIV/AIDS, which for a long time evangelicals didn't really pay attention to until it became something they could think about in terms of the continent of Africa. And so that it was no longer just a gay disease, that it was something that was expansive. And so they framed it as a necessary response to the excesses of the sexual revolution, right? Okay. And that, hey, we have this generation, this boomer generation from the free love generation, and they screwed everything up because now we have this problem with this explosion of STDs and teen pregnancy, and really created what sociologists call a moral panic, a sex panic. And that just dovetailed really nicely with a lot of the more mainstream cultural fears. And so this allowed the SBC and other evangelicals to just increase their connections to political power.
So you've been telling us about how political interests and sociological interests were behind driving this to such a crescendo. And the justification for that was often used, at least what I always heard, was it was based on biblical principles. And they always pointed to biblical passages. And yet the Bible doesn't teach anything at all about premarital sex, about abstinence, any of this. It's just not biblically based. And yet that was, as I understand it, the justification behind this big groundswell.
Right. Yeah. And, and evangelicals are very good at pulling out something out of context and applying it. So yeah, one of the frustrating things about studying these groups is that the theology is so thin. So it's not even interesting, right? And when you dig down, what you find is not theology. You find romantic mythologies, which are really powerful, right? And this is really sort of a romanticizing of these ideas, right? That, oh, God has prepared someone for you, that your future spouse is, that's not biblical. That's not at all a biblical idea. And that somehow, that you will kind of achieve all this thing called marriage that gets mapped. I mean, because the more effective thing that they did was, they mapped sort of the adolescent journey from adolescence to adulthood along the lines of purity teachings, so that one becomes an adult when they have successfully navigated adolescence and all the sexual temptations of it, and have resisted those temptations through the embrace of religion. And of course, the apotheosis of that, to use a big word, I just love that word because it reminds me of some sci-fi stuff. But like, I think the realization of that marriage is a kind of salvation. And in a political context where white evangelical Christians are trying to insert their family system as foundational to the U.S. nation state, that's super effective. So you can't pull apart the teen spirituality from the political work, from the, and of course, none of this was about teaching teenagers about actual sex. Right. It was all about a particular way of conforming yourself to a life and believing that that life was in your best interest in order to contribute to a culture and to this movement that today we're calling white Christian nationalism. And that this idea that these particular sets of values that we claim are Christian, which they're not exclusively Christian. There's purity teachings in all sorts of other religious groups. And so for Christians to sort of say we're the ones who know what's best is pretty brash as far as I'm concerned,
Arrogant.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, it's connected to American national identity, to white racial identity, and all these things, right? Right. You couldn't make this same argument and say, like, well, yes, in Islam, we practice modesty, and so they're not saying like, oh, anyone can do this within their religious tradition. They're saying you can only achieve this thing through these teachings if you are also committed to Jesus. And so I've heard stories of people, taking friends who were Hindu or Jewish to a purity event. And they were like, yeah, I believe that stuff, but I'm not going to convert. Right. So I think, again, there's an arrogance about that. And it's just become this whole thing. So when I talk about purity culture, I'm not talking about the individual choices that young people make or even older people make who say, I don't want this as a part of my life until I'm married or until I'm settled in a relationship. Those are separate decisions, right? We're talking about a whole network of politicized ideals that have used the bodies of adolescents to gain political power.
Very interesting. I'm curious. Of course, the focus of the podcast is on evangelicalism, but I am also curious about the Catholic element and the influence of the Catholic Church, because of course the Catholic Church also has very strict rules around purity and stuff like that. So what do you can you address that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's interesting because in many ways they are theologically interesting, right? They have actual theology behind this stuff, but have always been marginalized politically in the United States. But it is really fascinating to think about, right, Kennedy being elected and now Biden being elected, right? His Catholicism was nothing, right? But when Kennedy was elected, people thought he was the Antichrist. So yeah. I think we still need to keep that in mind. So my colleague Megan Goodwin makes the argument that evangelicals borrowed a lot of their sexual ethics from Roman Catholicism, but didn't take the theology because it's Roman Catholic theology. So the Virgin Mary adds such a different nuance in Roman Catholicism, deeply problematic for a lot of people, especially feminists who contend with that. But also Mary has been remade, right? She's a folk hero and she comes to represent so many different groups. I think of Our Lady of Guadalupe. I know that Catholics for Choice give out little Mary cards as well. So she is this feminine divine symbol that you don't have evangelicalism. And evangelicals don't have a theology of celibacy, right?
Right.
And of course, right, the Roman Catholic Church is a whole other quagmire of scary, awful stuff. Let's not get into that. But now, you know, and I remember when the Spotlight story came out, and now, and I always kept away from it in terms of teaching because I was like, I was worried about anti-Catholic bias because it's like, you know, the Protestants are just as bad, right? And now we know, right, from all right. the FCC stuff. So it's just a while, right? But I think that, you know, Catholics in many ways have been at the front of pushing sexual morality stuff, but they haven't had the kind of political power. Right. So evangelicals scoop that up. I would say probably 1970s formally, they started promoting the ideas, but had kind of crap theology behind it. All they could say is it's biblical. Right. Because there's really they don't have a deep theological tradition of Roman Catholicism. But Dr. Megan Goodwin makes the argument that like that Catholics really created this, what she calls prophylactic nationalism, this idea of, and for me, it's sort of, I think it dovetails nicely with what I call national innocence, right? That if we uphold these values and virtues around celibacy, chastity, purity, including, you know, deciding, right, who's an outsider, who are the people who are a threat? If we uphold that, then we're going to be a strong nation. We're going to maintain a strong relationship to God, and we're going to maintain that. So you hear that this is the kind of rhetoric that then gets popularized by people like Jerry Falwell. So yes, and so today we see, in fact, I think some of the most significant sort of leaders who promote what we call white Christian nationalism are in fact Roman Catholics, right? I think about former Vice President Mike Pence and the pro-life stuff, and this is all sort of a piece. Uh-huh. And the ethics of it are much more in place in Roman Catholicism than they are in evangelicalism.
Interesting.
There must be something uniquely American about this, because you're saying that the seeds are in Catholicism, but they didn't have power, at least not in America, but Southern America and all those European nations that are very Catholic, you didn't see this purity culture thing at all. Or at least, maybe I'm wrong. You correct me if I'm wrong.
It did go global thanks to groups like True Love Waits, right? So the Southern Baptist Convention is very good at doing things on a large scale. It seems like, you know, for a long time, they only did things on a large scale, and yet they couldn't figure out how to control, like, I don't know if I want to say this or not. So, but but it's just interesting that the Southern Baptist Convention was so effective at creating this global purity movement, especially on the continent of Africa, places like South Africa, and yet made the claim that because of their polity structure, when they were asked by survivors of sexual assault to create an accountability system, claimed that they couldn't because they didn't have a polity structure that allowed for that kind of overreaching authority. But you have the overreaching authority to be teaching sexual purity, right? So these things are happening at the same time, right? In the SBC, that sexual predators are able to do what they do, and the institution is telling all the kids to be sexually pure.
So based on Newton's law that every action has an equal and opposite reaction, there's also been a kind of a backlash against purity culture. I mean, Joshua Harris, of course, is most famously has renounced his previous book and so on. And so, yeah, maybe talk about that a bit, kind of the backlash now.
Yeah. So I started my dissertation in 2006 on this topic. And even then, there was no public backlash. There was no dissent. I was just trying to figure out, what is this all about? Why do people make this commitment? What does this tell us about adolescent spirituality and sexuality within evangelicalism? And so I have watched. Wasn't until, at least on my radar, it wasn't until 2013 that you get to this. But I'd say like 2010, people were blogging about it. But 2013 is when Elizabeth Smart gave a talk at Johns Hopkins University. So Elizabeth Smart was the young Mormon girl who was kidnapped from her home in Salt Lake City. She was held captive for 9 months. She was sexually assaulted. And in that time, there's a 13-year-old girl going through excruciating traumatic experiences. But what she remembered from her church was being taught that if you have sex before marriage, you're a chewed up piece of gum. And so she told this story, right? She now runs an organization that advocates for survivors of trafficking. But she told this story at a meeting of that group. And she said, this is what I had learned. And that's what came back to her in this moment of crisis. Not you are loved, God will protect you, but you're a chewed up piece of gum. And she said that contributed to her inability to be rescued, right? Because she was always being questioned by police officers. Are you Elizabeth Smart? Are you, you know, and because she didn't feel like her life had value, what had happened to her.
Yeah. Right?
So this is huge. And when she says that, there was just this crack in the evangelical blogosphere, right? And Rachel Held Evans steps in and, right? And she wrote about this in her book on biblical womanhood. Sarah Bessie stepped in, Elizabeth Esther. So all of these white evangelical feminists who were starting to push back on purity culture. And it was pretty mild at the beginning. And even the conversations would be like, you know, yeah, these things are bad, but also like, you know, we should save ourselves from air, right? So it was still kind of back and forth, but then the waves and waves, you know, and I'd like to sit down and think about it in terms of the waves. And I know a colleague of mine has done this. And so, you know, fast forward to 2017, and Emily Joy Allison has started the hashtag Church Too, right? And you have the hashtag Me Too movement going. And Emily Joy shares her experience, not of being sexually assaulted as a teenager, but of being groomed by a youth leader, an adult youth leader in her church, and not knowing what that meant, right? And so her book came out a year or two later, and I think really kind of solidified and gave us evidence. And of course, this was about the time all the SBC stuff was turning up, right? She grew up in the SBC world. And so now we see what has happened, that the people who grew up in purity culture are now sharing their stories and talking about how purity culture made them far more vulnerable to exploitation, to gender-based violence, to sexual violence. And it's just this fire hose that has not been closed, right? Or rather, fire hydrant, right? And it's now getting more attention than even these initial teachings. to the point now. So it's interesting because I don't know if you have followed the controversy around Josh Butler's book.
No.
So a chapter of his book. So he's a, I believe he's SBC. A chapter of his book was published by the Gospel Coalition, and the pushback was severe because it's very phallocentric. It's very much about men's sexuality dominating how we define sex at all. And it got so much pushback that I don't know that the TCG had to issue an apology. I believe it's been pulled from publication, but you want to check me on that because it's right. It's, and this just been happening in the last 4 or 5 months. So this is how far we've come, right? This is like a grown-up Joshua Harris,
right?
Kind of book, like, oh, this is what sex really is, right? But it's all so, it's deeply patriarchal, right? And there's nothing about women's experience of enjoying, you know, of sex being something that women can and should enjoy. It only focuses on the sexual pleasure of men, and it spiritualizes things like sperm and stuff like that. So it's been, yeah. It reminds me a lot. There were a lot of evangelical sex ed manuals in the 1970s. And so it reminds me a lot of that.
Okay.
But the fact that there's been this huge backlash, that tells you how full circle we've become.
Yeah.
Right.
So he resigned as a pastor because of the controversy. And part of it is because what people say now, right? Now what we say, and it's been interesting, because again, as a scholar, I try and observe this, right? So what people are saying now is that purity culture is rape culture. Okay.
Right. Wow.
This was,
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was, and this was something I was sitting with for a long time. And I think that was something I could see, but I wanted to wait for other people to say it, right? Who were much closer to it than I was. And now it's everywhere. And
how would they express that link? Like what, why would they describe purity culture as rape culture?
So purity culture teaches boys and men's sexuality is innately aggressive. Girls and women's sexuality is innately passive, even to the point where women and girls are not sexually interested, right? Beyond bearing children. I've interviewed people who said they were taught that sex wasn't for them to enjoy. And so had like a decade of miserable marriage thinking, yeah, okay, this is, you know, it's the whole wifely duty, right? It's not something for you to enjoy. So you put those together and you're naturalizing, you know, rape between men and women because you're saying, well, men are naturally aggressive. Women are naturally passive and nurturing, and therefore it's women and girls' job to make sure men's sexuality is contained.
Right.
And this comes out, and you can trace this all the way back to James Dobson, to some other conservative people who are sort of using this as if it's an anthropological truth, right? So you're naturalizing male aggression, you're naturalizing female passivity, right? So then rape is something that, of course, is going to happen. Isn't it a shame? As opposed to saying, no, all of these ideas about sexuality actually create this circumstance. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard pastors say women are the gatekeepers. You know, they have to defend the castle. Mm-hmm. The men are storming the castle. It's the women's job to defend the castle, you know, and this kind of thing, right? So I think you're absolutely right about that. I mean, obviously, putting it into terms of rape is an extreme way of saying it to make a point. I mean, in my own experience, I became an evangelical when I was around 16 or so. This would have been in the late 70s. And it was interesting because sex was such a big topic, you know, in youth groups and teaching and stuff like that. Because, I mean, for adolescents, sex is a big topic, right? I mean, that's just biological. But what I found interesting coming from a completely non-Christian background was the sexual aggressiveness, you know, in these church groups. There was lots going on. There was more going on there than I had experienced in the secular world that I grew up in. And so it's a bit of a paradox that is the case. And so what you're saying is not really surprising. And I think that what we're seeing now, like, as you mentioned, the fall of all of these leaders and so on to various sexual temptations, Ravi Zacharias and others, it's kind of blown the lid off that, right? It's shown that it's been a facade in a lot of ways, but underneath the covers, to use a metaphor. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I hope you'll let me push back on some of your language a bit.
Go ahead.
Because I do study, and I have been, and part of a cohort of scholars who study religion and sexual abuse. And so when I say rape, I mean rape. When I say rape culture, I mean rape culture, right? A normalization of rape that has happened within white evangelicalism, right? So it's not extreme, it's descriptive. This is where we are at.
Okay.
And when people try and talk it away, like the Southern Baptist Church, I don't know how they're going to figure this out, because people keep saying, like, they're so protective.
Right.
You know, the other part you mentioned, you know, Ravi Zacharias and mentioned the word temptation, right? He was a serial abuser.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't about him being tempted. It was about.
No, that's true.
Him being entitled to his sexual desire.
Right? No, that's a good point. Yeah.
And that's what white evangelicalism has done. And purity culture has allowed that. It allows men to behave this way, right? And it's this,
right.
And we have all the evidence. It also explains why white evangelicals in the United States were perfectly fine voting for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Right. Even after he said what he said, right? Even after we know, right, he has done this. So I think this is the way we're trying to change the culture, right? And say, like, this is the culture. It is, you know, and part of the purity culture as well in white evangelicalism is the myth of that the white evangelical family, the foundation of the nation state, is a safe place.
Right.
And so sex needs to be taught in the home and not in the schools. But that's myth-making, right? It's the same kind of myth-making that we use around the United States as this innocent nation. Families are innocent. This is where we keep our children innocent. But for a lot of people, family is not innocent. And for a lot of kids who grew up in the SBC, church wasn't a safe space, and family wasn't a safe space. A lot of the people there's one woman named Hannah Kate who is a huge advocate. She is a survivor. Her father was an SBC clergy, and she was a survivor of incest. And the church has just treated her horribly and not done anything to keep what happened to her, right? And now church leaders just really treat her badly. So this is where I've gotten really closely more connected with the survivor community. They're very active on social media. And some people listening may hear me as being somehow extreme and want to say, well, that's only a small percentage, or that's right. This is what we do with things that we cannot sit with, right? But that has got to change if we're really going to make churches safe, if we're going to make families safe.
Right.
It's painful to hear that church and family can be an unsafe place.
For sure.
Now, I want to tie up a loose thread that we left hanging here. And if you're okay with this question, Sarah, I'm guessing you got into this area of study, you know, decades before the point we're now talking about. You got into that out of interest. You were in Christ at that time, and you were interested in how the church was dealing with all this sexuality. Mm-hmm. And in studying it for a decade or two, I think you lost your faith somewhere along the way. Was it because of this subject that you were studying so closely?
I wouldn't say I've lost my faith. I'm no longer a Christian, but I have gained so much more than I've lost in that transition. And yeah, I don't know, because I was well out of evangelicalism. And I went into all other forms of Christianity. I lived in a Mennonite community for a while. I have a seminary degree from a Methodist seminary. I went through the rites of Christian initiation for adults in the Catholic Church. And then I ended up in the Episcopal Church, right? So I have, eaten from the buffet and hoping to find a spiritual home. And I do remember actually saying to myself in graduate school when I was working on my PhD, it's okay if you're not a Christian, right? I didn't know if I was or wasn't at that point. And I said, it's okay if you're not. And I was like, whoa, that, and like things really shifted for me. And then, you know, I've spent many years not going to church. And now I say to myself, you know, if you are still a little Christian, that's okay. But at this point in my life, I'm very drawn to pre-Christian spirituality of Ireland. So Celtic paganism and wanting to understand that pre-Christian, you know, before Christianity, because this is where my ancestors are from. And that has really shifted me in terms of just my orientation toward the world and how I think about divinity. And now when I think about my divinity, I'm like, oh, yeah. Although do you remember the Beliefmatic?
No,
Beliefmatic, no.
Net.com. It was like 20 years ago and you could take a quiz and it's still around. BeliefNet is no longer around, but you can still take the quiz. And I was just reminded of it. So I took it and I came out as Unitarian Universalist, which is because all of my friends now are UU. And I've been told I dress like a UU pastor. but there was a time when I was really drawn to liturgy, to high church stuff. I just thought there was so much beauty and mystery in that. And you see, you know, because now that I study this group called Exvangelicals, I see a lot of people who do that. When I first started reading Rachel Held Evans, I was like, you're going to be Episcopalian, right? And like two books later, right, there it was, right? Yeah. So it's really interesting to sort of see, and I'm sure there'll be people studying that particular development of how people, so to think about it as loss of faith, I think is a little disingenuous, right? Because it's people searching, you know, this is very American, right? We have this religious marketplace where you sort of dip in and figure out kind of where, what works for you. And so that's what we see with evangelicals now and kind of the decisions they're making. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that you've hinted at a few times in our conversation, and I know it's an important part of your work, is this linkage between the rise of purity culture and Christian nationalism. So maybe you could talk about that. What is that linkage and how do the two relate to each other?
Yeah, well, so I was just talking to a reporter at Slate just before this, and she contacted me. I didn't realize this, but Senator Tim Scott has announced his candidacy for president. And when he first started running for office, he was 30 years old. It was in the mid-1990s. And he referred to himself publicly as a proud virgin. And so she wanted me to sort of make sense of that. And it makes perfect sense considering his context. And this is when True Love Waits was everywhere. And it was the decade of the proud virgin. But the other thing that happened in the 1990s was the Southern Baptist Convention, you know, had this rolling out of True Love Waits, and their first big event happened in Washington, D.C. at an event co-sponsored between True Love Waits and Youth for Christ. It was called D.C. 94, right? So one of these youth rallies, but they were in D.C., so there was a group of Southern Baptist youth who were going to be meeting with President Clinton, who was also Southern Baptist. But the other thing they did was they had a massive display of purity pledge cards on the lawn of the National Mall. So True Love Waits would have students sign these cards and sign two of them. You'd keep one for yourself and you'd send one back to the organization. They'd collect them all. So this was in 94. They started the campaign in 92. So within 2 years, they had over 200,000 of these cards, and they got teenagers to attach them to tiny stakes, and they pounded them into the lawn of the National Mall. And so if you do a Google image search for this, you can find, it's a striking image. You have, you know, this huge lawn with all these little cards on it, and then behind it, the U.S. Capitol building. Right. So right away, we know this is not just about getting horny teenagers to do the right thing in the backseat. Right. There is a national message here. And in the True Love Waits Bible, Richard Ross, who founded the group, talked about how it would be sexually pure teenagers who would revive the nation, who would restore the moral core of the nation, right? So from the very beginning, there's this idea that sexual purity is essential to a thriving nation state. And of course, this was part of the plans of the Moral Majority that formed in the early 1980s, was to really politicize the issues that were most important to evangelicals that were also functional, you know, kind of broader moral crises. And so they were able to do that very effectively and then offer sort of their own theology as the solution. Right? Because sexual purity isn't possible, as they teach, right, without the assistance of Jesus Christ. Right? So there was never any attempt to sort of hide that piece of it. But it's very much, right, part of this larger network, part of this larger narrative about making the United States a strong nation. And that strength means having a good relationship with a particular version of God, right? The white evangelical God. And that God's gotten a lot of power. And I think in the United States now, we can look at the overturn of Roe v. Wade. That was exactly part of this trajectory.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just about changing hearts and minds. It was about creating homeschool coalitions, really working at the grassroots, and then getting these kids into places like Patrick Henry College and Liberty University, getting them to go on and become lawyers and on to the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, we had Frank Schaefer on a while back, and he was there at the birth of the Christian right, and he was part of the birth of the Christian right, and it's come kind of full circle. I mean, Roe v. Wade was the galvanizing issue. But one thing I'm curious about is how do you deal with the paradox, given what you've just said about purity and tying it to nationalism and all that, the paradox of the rise of Trump. I mean, if you'd ask me, given that background of purity and all that, you would have expected probably some sort of a, quote, Christian president who was, you know, had, you know, like a Mike Pence, let's say,
right,
as opposed to a Donald Trump. But instead, we have Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So how did they square that circle?
And that's a big question, right? And I think the first thing we need to consider is Trump's predecessor was the first Black president of the United States. And that's created a huge growth of white nationalist organizations.
Right.
And Trump spent 8 years dogging him and saying, you know, he's not duly elected. He's not a citizen. He's a Muslim. Right.
Yeah.
And so did all this myth making. So we have these myths of national innocence, and myths of sexual innocence are very helpful for maintaining. So Trump is able to do all this white supremacist myth-making around Obama, and in that gain a following of people who were like, yes, we need America to be America again. It needs to be run by a white man, right?
Yeah.
Who is willing to do what it takes to make sure white Christianity stays in power. And of course, right, we've saw all the spectacular failings of Trump's attempts at piety, right? I think my favorite was the Bible, when they actually smoke bombed protesters at a Black Lives Matter rally and went to an Episcopal church and he held the Bible. It was an Episcopal church. And listening to the priest after that, and she was one of the people who was, it was just like, how do you just not, you know, I mean,
yeah.
Really, like, stuff that I think was just meant to so throw us off, like you were completely disarmed, right? Like, what do you do with that?
Right.
And I think it's just the brute force of it that white evangelicals are drawn to. Because again, the muscular Christianity, the nationalism, and especially it's this brute force white Christianity that emerges immediately after our first Black president.
Yeah.
So
too much of a coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I think that's it. And I follow all the debates on Twitter between scholars who are about, you know, what is white Christian nationalism? And there are people now who were like, we're not sure what it is. And there's like 12 books written about it by experts. So we do know what it is. It's just that you're not willing to admit like how much it really is part of our culture. And because it already was, right? Trump didn't invent anything. Right.
No.
Supersized it and weaponized fear. Right.
Yeah.
Because that's
what I mean, Trump to me is he's a classic and a really a brilliant populist. You know, he read the temperature and he fed to a group of the American people what they wanted to hear. And he did. And he's quite brilliant, you know. And that's what I appreciate the clarification on the rape culture thing. And the reason I said what I said, I guess, is because you hear people talk about toxic masculinity and that all men are rapists, you know, deep inside all men are rapists and stuff. That's the kind of thing that stuff doesn't sit well. But having described it as you have, that a rape culture is the promotion of this side of men that is not good,
And
that's been good for me to hear that because.
Yeah. Well, and you prop, so that stuff, right? All men are rapists. Or I think the argument, you know, I think of Andrea Dworkin's argument back in the 80s, right? She was this radical separatist feminist who said like all heterosexual sex is rape, right? Yeah, right. Which is an extremist view, very
of course.
So. But and I think it's important to think about this as a culture. It's a cultural of sexual harassment. It's a patriarchal culture.
Right.
Is
right.
What it is. And it puts pressure. And this is so in talking to people like Brad Onishi, my colleague who studies men and purity culture, right? The kind of pressure that is put on men to be a certain kind of man.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and I'm sure you've read Jesus and John Wayne.
Yeah.
And the response to that has been really astounding, I think. And I think a lot of men have needed to hear that. Like, oh, we don't need to be this thing, right? This is kind of BS.
Yeah. Right?
And it is harmful to men. It's harmful to men's bodies and souls.
Right.
And so this is what white evangelicals and the people coming out of white evangelicalism are having to kind of sort through. And of course, this is not exclusive to evangelicalism, but we've tied it up with the idea of what it means to be a good Christian.
Right.
To be a good Christian is to be a manly Christian. To be a good Christian is to be a submissive woman. And now we're seeing that come to fruition, right, in this sexual abuse crisis. I mean, how could it, you know, because that's what it leads to.
I'm curious then, we've talked a lot about both sides of the issue and so on, but then what is the balance? What is the solution? Because we have also seen during the sexual revolution and so on, there are negative effects of the sexual revolution as well, right? You know, in the sense of teen pregnancy and these kinds of things that are also negative or can be. But what is the balance in your feeling after all your research? Yeah.
So as a historian of sexuality, I have a different take on the sexual revolution.
Okay.
A lot of historians agree the more important sexual revolution happened in the 1920s. Because what happened in the 1920s is culturally, it became more acceptable to separate sex from procreation, right? And of course, that was the battle over birth control throughout the 20th century, right? And several things happened during the sexual revolution, including married people getting the right to use birth control legally. It was not legal for even married couples to use it. And it was and it was clergy who were pushing that in the same way that it was clergy who were helping women find ways to have abortions before Roe v. Wade, right? Because they considered it an important part of their ministry. So I think there's a lot of ways we can complicate this narrative around the sexual revolution. But it is really interesting the way the sexual revolution, the stuff that you have said, Scott, about what you experienced in the 70s, right? The sexual revolution hit evangelicalism. And that's really fascinating because evangelicals always like to define themselves as being right. But so I don't necessarily think of it in terms of middle ground, But I will say the thing that we don't have, that I didn't have even as a kid, that we didn't have in the 60s and 70s, is the concept of consent. This is something so many of us had no idea what that meant, what that means to really be able to make active choices about your sexuality. And of course, purity culture did not help with that. And in the 90s, 2000s, and even now, like, purity culture has dominated a lot of sex education, which focuses more on the harms caused by premarital sex as opposed to consent. And now that is, you know, especially on college campuses, that has become really powerful rhetoric. And it always needs to be nuanced, and we need a better understanding of what that means. And I see places like the SBC. I don't even know that if you have the complementarian theology, as I read it, does not promote consent. And I know I have interviewed people who said they grew up being taught that rape doesn't exist in marriage. So these kinds of things. So this is where we need to go. So it's not so much how do we resolve, but where do we need to go next, right? And yeah, we are in, I think, a significant moment because of our heightened awareness around the extent of sexual abuse and the way that our understandings of gender feed into that. So yeah, so we're poised to learn some great things. And the fact that, you know, Josh Butler got so much pushback gives me hope that people even within evangelicalism are like, no, that's crap. Like, we need to do a better job of adults saying, like, I don't know about sex, and now I have these kids. A lot of it is people growing up out of purity culture and then having their own kids and be like, I don't want them to be taught this stuff I've been taught. So I do see, like, kind of the hope in this generation of people who've come out of the really intense purity culture of the 90s and 2000s, who are having a bit of a mini sexual revolution in many ways. Mm-hmm. A lot of that is around gender identity. It's not just around sex. In fact, I was just reading an article that, like, adolescent sexual behavior is continuing to drop. And so if adolescents having sex is a problem, which I don't know that I would say that, but I know that everywhere else would, including sort of on the political, you know, public health level. But those numbers are dropping, and young people are actually more interested and have a very sophisticated understanding of gender. And so these things are evolving. And I think we need to pay attention to that, pay attention to what the young people are doing and how they're making sense of their experiencing, right? How they identify. And I think we're going to get a lot of hints of how do we heal this? Because it is being healed in some places, right? I mean, yes, generational healing does happen. And I think it is happening in some places.
Yeah. Excellent.
Okay. So, Sarah, we're getting very short on time, but I did want to hear one last thing. You're heading up the project, the Purity Project. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah. So it's called the After Purity Project. This is the name of my research. And as I mentioned previously, so over the last 3 years, I have interviewed 65 people who've grown up and out of purity culture. Now I am getting to interview scholars who have who've studied related topics. And so I'm working on a book project about, it's called After Purity, Religion, Race, and Sex in White Christian Nationalism. And I'm also working on a podcast project that's trying to trace the history of sexual purity back to the 19th century and demonstrate the way that it is part of the construction of white racial identity and the way that it very much has functioned as a deeply racist and deeply violent concept. Because if you're studying sexual purity historically, you have to look at racial terror lynchings, where the myths around racial terror lynchings involve this notion that white women were naturally sexually pure and Black men were sexually dangerous. And this is a huge part of U.S. history that we are just beginning to contend with. So purity culture, even though it was adopted by Black communities, especially in the early 20th century, is something that was constructed to reinforce white racial dominance. Hmm. That's what I'm looking at.
Okay. We'll have links in the show notes, not only to your faculty page, but also to this project. Are you looking for volunteers for that, interviewees?
So I am done interviewing at this point.
Okay, all right.
Yes.
All right.
Yeah. So I'm currently not taking on new folks. But 4 years ago, there were a group of graduate students who got together and started the Purity Culture Research Collective. And so there are many young scholars doing research on purity culture. And so there's always something going on that people can participate in. So, and there's lots of new, exciting research that's going to be coming out. So lots of opportunities for people to tell their stories about their experience in purity culture.
Okay. And we'll have that in our show notes again, a link to all of that stuff and to your books. Sarah, thank you so much for giving us your time and your expertise too. It's been an entirely different perspective than what we had, and it's been great to include it in this conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again. We'll see you, Sarah. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Recovering Evangelicals with your hosts, Luke Jansen and Scott Dyer. Send your comments and suggestions for new episodes to lukejjansen@gmail.com. Join our private discussion group on Facebook by searching for the Recovering Evangelicals podcast group. Look for the logo that you always see at your favorite podcast catcher and ask to be let in. Subscribe to lukejjansen.wordpress.com if you want to get advanced releases and group posts. Or browse through our archive for a full listing of all our previous episodes. And please help the podcast by sharing with a friend and leaving a review at your favorite podcast catcher.